Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? You can watch it.
Oh. And we're talking to Carol the Coach. Hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen Sheets, and I am so happy to be with you tonight. You know, this is a show where I try to inspire, motivate, and educate you to feel better about your sexual addiction and to know that there are definitely things that you can do to make your life better and actually to be your higher self. You know, here's what I believe, that when somebody is plagued with an obstacle and they just don't feel like they're living their life to the fullest potential, it is so important to say to yourself, okay, how can I take this obstacle? How can I make myself stronger? What can I learn from it? Matter of fact, I'm getting ready to do a workshop on the gifts of sexual addiction. So I want you to believe, truly, there are gifts to this sexual addiction. And when you do, you'll feel more hopeful and you'll not be so repulsed by the behavior. Instead, you'll figure out what you need to do to work with it. And, you know, I know that that can be rough because you have been feeling a lot of shame and a lot of guilt, and you've wondered why you, and you've wondered if you're always going to be a prisoner to this horrible, horrible affliction. And I guess what I'm saying to you is, you will always have this affliction to have to manage. But when you do the work, the good news is that you no longer have to feel a prisoner. You can actually say to yourself, okay, I've got this under control. I am a better person. It has brought me to my feelings. I can manage my life. I can be the husband or the wife I need to be to my husband. And isn't that the most important thing in the world, that you be able to do that? I mean, I know that it is definitely the most important thing that you need to do. So, you know me. I am available at carolthecoach@aol.com at any point. And you can go to my website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach. That's always a good website to go to take the SAS, which is the sexual addiction assessment test, so that you can determine, is this a problem or is it just maybe a phase that I'm going through? Well, more often than not, if you're already willing to take that test, you truly do know that it is a problem. It is not a phase. But we've got lots of information on my website. There are so many good websites to go to. And you can always email me. A lot of people are kind of fearful of talking on the air. This is a dark situation. They are uncomfortable, so they email me instead. And when that occurs, I got to tell you, that's when your life can change for the best. So I recently got an email from a woman, and she's actually continued to talk with me about some of the issues that are plaguing both she and her husband. And so I want to talk about this today because she has some questions. Her name is Sandy, and her husband's Paul. And she says, you know, my husband has a lot of problems, exhibits signs of late-stage sexual addiction. We have sexual anorexia in our marriage. He's moved to the basement in a cot and a sleeping bag. And he's considering divorce. She says, I have read lots of information. I've attended Essanon meetings. I've done my own recovery. My husband took the SAST and scored a 6, which says, yes, he does have an issue. She says, my husband overindulged in alcohol in the past, been a longstanding pattern, and has resulted in breaking lots of he's broken some bones as a result of his alcoholism. She says his life is a mess. She has walked in on him several times attempting masturbation, and even when he had broken bones, still compulsively was trying to please himself sexually. So she says, there are things that are troublesome and make me question sexual addiction. He has constant denial, wants a divorce, and he maintains that he has been silently unhappy for 12 of our 14 years. So, here's what she asked me. She says, hey, Carol, masturbates to porn sometimes 6 to 7 times a week, goes to strip clubs frequently, has had habitual affairs. I've known that he has previously visited chat rooms, had phone sex relationship, and he has done a lot of role-playing, which he now claims disgusts him. I guess I'm more confused than ever. I doubt my suspicions every day. So her questions to me are, can a sex addict have physical and emotional affairs at the same time? Absolutely. No doubt about it. Now, you know, we say sex addiction is an addiction of emotional and physical problems with intimacy. So, yes, one can have an affair because clearly what happens is when somebody's just deciding to have an affair, they're in a higher state of dopamine in their brain. They're not really dealing with the real issues. And the relationship is more fantasy-based. She asks, can a sex addict rely solely on masturbation with porn? And that is absolutely true. A lot of times, sexual addiction waxes and wanes. Although it progressively gets worse, there can be periods of sexual anorexia, and there can be periods of where a man says, oh, well, I'm just masturbating. That's all I am doing. Okay, so it's important for the addict to know what his or her history is. Now, this is a woman who I can sense has a love-hate relationship with her husband. She's just fed up. Boy, she's focusing so much on him, you know? She needs to start focusing on herself, but I'm sure those self-help books that she's reading encourages her to focus in on herself. It's hard for a partner to do that. They are so traumatized. they so badly want to believe that if they can find the magic cure, they can make things better, when in actuality, they can't. So, what I would tell Miss Sandy to do is to really, really, really focus in on herself. And that is very, very difficult, but it will be well worth her while. And the other thing that she asks is, I have to turn the page here. Sandy asks, and there's a lot of anger in her questions, could my husband just simply be a selfish, narcissistic jerk, not a sex addict? Well, Sandy, I'm not a name caller, and I refuse to do that, so I'm not going to call your husband a selfish, narcissistic jerk. What we do know is that there are some sex addicts who are narcissistic. If you're narcissistic, that automatically means that you're selfish. So it is very possible that that could be going on. She says, he has given me few details and has charged the story to many, many, many factors. He's constantly changing the story, too. He forgets what he tells me. And she says, I don't know what to believe. Each day, a little bit more trickles out. This is maddening, and I have no control over my life. Well, boy, I can understand that, because that's one of the most painful situations of a partner. When they get a little bit of the information over a long period of time, what ends up happening is that they get traumatized so badly. It's like being in a war zone. They're just waiting for the other shoe to fall. And so this is a woman who has been very, very traumatized. And I'm glad she's working with a CSAT. She needs somebody who can really help her with her issues. It can't happen soon enough. So she's doing her reading. She's looking for good recovery materials. Of course, Mending the Shattered Heart is an excellent one. Facing the Heartbreak is an excellent one. As she says, that she did see a psychologist in the past, but that psychologist was not CSAT certified. So now she has met with a CSAT a couple of different times. So she is on the right track. And it takes a long time. And she has put up with it for an extended amount of time. So all I can say is that I understand that he has hurt her deeply. Now it's time for her to get back to her support group, Essanon meetings, and to really work hard at taking care of herself. And if she needs a break from the relationship, she needs a break from the relationship. And I highly recommend a man by the name of Milt Magnus. Dr. Magnus has a program for partners. It's pricey. You go and you spend 3 days really working out the issues, getting all the information, going about a polygraph test, sometimes 2 and 3 of them before you leave. He has reading materials for you. He has homework assignments. He has check-ins. He gives you hope, strength, and recovery. So, Sandy, take a look at Dr. Milt Magnus. He will clearly make you feel better about your current situation. Okay, now tonight I am so excited because there's this new book that has come out. And it is exactly what so many Christians are looking for. You know, I'm a believer that truly recovery occurs when you experience a spiritual transformation. And some Christians can do that through the 12-step program. And other Christians want the 12-step program, but they also want a very scriptural, spiritually-based program. So, lo and behold, there is a new book called Shadows of the Cross. And it is a companion to a book that has just been a Bible for us CSATs called Facing the Shadows. You know, you've heard me say it before, I always recommend the workbook Facing the Shadows. Well, this book is called Shadows of the Cross. It was written by Craig S. Cashwell, PhD, Penny K. Johnson, LPC, and, of course, the great Patrick J. Carnes. It's a Christian companion to Facing the Shadows, and it's an amazing way to do the performables, the recovery test that Dr. Carnes has found to be so helpful in getting your life together. And so we're going to be talking with Craig Cashwell tonight about this book, why it's different, why it really speaks to a certain population, why it may be exactly the book that you're looking for to help you pull everything together. Shadows of the Cross focuses on sex addiction recovery for Christian men and women. And so I am so pleased to have Craig on the show to talk about this book and the kind of work he has been doing with sex addicts and their partners. So, Craig, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Carol. It's good to be with you.
Absolutely. I'm so thankful. I have so much gratitude that this book has come out because it really is a workbook for Christians who scripturally want some additional support in their recovery program. They may really enjoy the 12 steps, but the scriptural basis for their recovery is what they need to actually solidify, you know, the goals that they're going towards. So tell me, how did this book come to be?
Well, I think it's an interesting story, Carol. When I was going through my CSAT training and actually was in my last module, there was a request for anyone who wanted to work on a paper, and the content of the paper was a secondary analysis of some data from the SDI, the Sexual Dependence Inventory, for men who self-identified when they took the instrument as Christian. And what we were doing, we were looking at all the consequences that they had reported, and we were sort of rolling that out to pastoral counselors and clergy, because so often, you know, as you know, when these for folks who are in religious communities, when they struggle with some of these behaviors when they first come to light, often the first person that they turn to is a counselor within their church or a member of their clergy, and so we wanted to put this information in their hands in a way that would really help them sort of understand the problem, understand addiction, and also to understand the types of consequences that these men were facing. And we also, in that paper, we rolled out the Pathos, the quick screen that is now in use. And so that was what brought Penny and I together. Penny Johnson, at the time now, Penny Johnson Carnes, that's how she and I first began to work together. And out of that relationship started some conversations with Pat Carnes, who said he really had sort of had a vision for this book for a long time, and it had just never quite come to fruition. So that's how we started the initial conversations. Once we started talking about sort of our shared vision for the book, it was just very clear we were on the same page. We felt the need for it. We saw the importance of it. And from that point on, it just sort of really took off at that point.
Well, it sounds like some good people collaborated to make this thing happen. And Shadows of the Cross provides that early spiritual focus to recovery, you know, addressing the issues of sexuality in a non-shaming way using biblical scripture. So, you know, clearly there was a lack in the community. There weren't the resources necessary, and this really is a companion to facing the shadows, is it not?
That's exactly right. Yeah, the philosophy behind this is that, you know, for people who treat clients who for whom their religious identity is particularly salient for them, when they go through Facing the Shadow, which is, of course, a tried and true approach to early recovery, they're asking the question, where is God in this? You know, where is God in this recovery process? And so if you look at the 30 test model of Carnes, developing a spiritual life comes a bit later in the tasks, although of course we don't always do those in a sequential way, but the intent of that is really clear, I think, because sometimes people who are highly religious, they'll actually avoid the psychological work. They don't want to do that psychological work, and they sort of seek the answers solely in the spiritual realm. And so the philosophy of this book really was that, you know, for many people, this work is, well, I personally, my personal opinion is that this work for everyone is both psychological and spiritual. And so, yeah, the way the book was set up, we have, I think, three chapters at the beginning of the book that sort of set the stage, but every chapter after that in Shadows of the Cross actually is a parallel chapter to one of the chapters in Facing the Shadows. And so we're often encouraging people to go do particular pieces of the work in Facing and then come back and we'll look more at the spiritual aspects of that task and that performable in Shadows of the Cross. So they're absolutely meant to be sort of worked through side by side.
Okay, so now we got a little bit of a feeling as to why the book was conceived. And so, like you said, you co-authored this book with Penny Johnson Carnes and Patrick Carnes. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like to work with them?
Sure. And I suspect that many of the folks listening in know one or both of them, and they're absolutely wonderful people. And I think we were put together on this project, a bit of a divine conspiracy, is how I might say it, to put the three of us together working on this, because we really had a shared vision for it. The very first conversations that we had before a single word had been written, when we were just talking philosophically about it, I actually thought of the title of the book while I was mowing my lawn, of all things. And I was listening to some music, and I heard a particular song, and it spurred this idea for the title. And that evening, I had already had a conference call set up. And before I could say anything, Penny said, well, the title of the book has come to me. And I thought, uh-oh, we're about to have different ideas about the title. And she had exactly the same title. We came to it independently at the same time. So it was really, you know, that sort of divine providence. I'm sure there are people in the world that would call that a coincidence, but I simply don't believe that's true. And there were other instances
right.
like that. Yeah, right? So it was, how crazy was that? And I, even now, talking to you, Carol, I get chills talking about that, because it was so clear that for me, you know, my own faith is very, very important. And it just, from the moment we started this project, it had a very embodied quality to me. I just felt very passionate about it. Writing is hard work, but writing this book never felt like work. It felt like a real blessing to be able to work on it. So, but you know, both Penny and Pat were just amazing to work with, just brilliant people. Penny in particular has this gift for storytelling. So what we did in many of the chapters is Penny would write these fictional narratives that were modern-day accounts of parables that Jesus told, to sort of put a contemporary spin on things. And then we would come in behind that, and we would sort of use journaling and use some process-oriented questions to help people sort of reflect on the message of the parable and what it meant for them in recovery. And she would send me the stories to look at, and they were just beautifully written and very touching. They would move me to tears consistently, because they were just these deep truths in the stories that I think really touched some things that are universal for us. So it was a real blessing to work with them. They're so talented, just brilliant writers and just lovely people at the same time.
Okay, so you said she's a natural-born storyteller. And let's face it, people want they want the tools and they want the theoretical, but they also want the narrative. They want to know they're not alone. And this book really goes into great detail to say you're not alone. That's what I was so impressed with. It's so human.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I think, you know, churches are complicated institutions. And some of the most beautiful things in the world happen within religious communities. And then some of the worst things in the world happen within religious communities, because they're at their core, they're sort of human-made institutions composed of humans who we're all very fallible. We're all imperfect. We're all broken in our own sorts of ways. And so, you know, there are many religious communities out there that do a wonderful job of talking about what a healthy sexuality looks like. But I think if we're honest, we would say, but there are a lot of faith communities that don't. And because this is not being talked about a lot in churches, there's that tendency, we talk about it as that Jekyll and Hyde sort of syndrome where, you know, a person leads this very public sort of, have this sort of public persona. They might be a leader in the church. They might be a teacher in the church. They might be very well respected in the church, but they've got this secret. And so hopefully what we can do with this is, yeah, exactly like you're saying, help people know they're not alone. We know that this is a problem within the religious community. And help them know that there's also help available. I think that's really critical because there's, you know, isolation is such a part of addiction anyway. And sometimes I think in religious communities it can actually be even more so, unfortunately.
Well, and that's what I love about this book, too, is because truly there is, you know, any person that has a sexual addiction does their best to hide it. And when you have that Jekyll and Hyde thing going on and you're a deacon or an elder in your church and you really are doing great things and yet you have this whole secret life, it seems to me that it's sometimes harder to, no pun intended, expose yourself to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so this book really helps people to come up with the recovery tools necessary to really change their life. And you're right. I mean, clearly, I get my best referrals from priests, from ministers, from pastors, from rabbis, because that's where the confessions occur. When people can no longer stand it, they reach out to the leaders in their church. Sometimes the leaders also have that problem. So, I mean, I just see this as a wonderful book for everybody in the community.
Yeah, I'm glad you added that last part. I mean, I think we have to face the fact that there are, you know, a substantial number of clergy who are very isolated, who are struggling with this. And if you know, deacons and elders and leaders in the church don't feel like they have a support, you know, who do the clergy turn to? You know, once they expose their struggle, then they're running the risk of losing their job, being, you know, sort of leaving the church in a cloud of shame. And it's just very, very hard for them to find the support that they need. So, yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And then there's, you know, whatever messages, you know, we all got messages growing up, those of us who grew up in the church, we all got messages about our sexuality. And some of them weren't particularly sex positive or sex affirming. They could be very shaming in lots of ways. And so, yeah, I think it just sort of complicates that a bit, where people are disinclined. It just stays very hidden, unless there's that sort of breaking point, like you say, where they go to a clergy or someone and confess, which is, of course, we know where the first step begins.
You know, it's so interesting because I was talking with a young college-age woman, and her sexual behaviors are out of control, and she's participating in three-way, four-way, five-way. So, I mean, she has a relationship that is allegedly exclusive, and she loves this person, but she cannot sexually stop being compulsive. And she confesses every week to priest. And you know, I was talking to her. She says, I just feel so much better that I can at least let one other person know what I'm doing. And I said, gee, how's he handling it? What's he telling you to do? I didn't know if there were Hail Marys. I didn't know if there was rosary stuff. She says, you know, he doesn't really give me much advice. It just feels so good to talk about it. And that in and of itself is very helpful, but you really aren't going to get healthy in confession or just in talking about it. You have to know what to do. You have to know what the action plan is. And these performables in the shadows of the cross are instrumental in increasing recovery. So can we go over a couple of those performables?
Sure.
You want to give a couple that you think are highlights?
Yeah, so let me think about that for a second. So one of the things that we talk about, one that comes to mind for me in the book, is that we talk about there's a passage of scripture in 2 Corinthians where Paul talks about having a thorn in his flesh. It's one of my favorite passages personally. And he talks about basically, he's basically thanking God for giving him this weakness because it causes him to recognize that he needs help and to rely on God. Now, far greater theologians than I have debated what that thorn in the flesh was. Some think it was a physical limitation. Some think it was a speech impediment. Some think it was some sort of illness. But the reality is we don't know. People are literally, the best minds are sort of guessing. But when you read that through the lens of addiction, when you read that through the lens of someone who is in, there's another passage in which Paul writes that, I do the very thing that I don't want to do. That sounds like addictive behavior to me. And so, again, we don't know that Paul was an addict. I can't say, you know, unequivocally, but I can toss my guess in with with other people who are just guessing at what his struggle was. And so what we do with that, as we do with many other places, with it, other passages, is we basically ask people to reflect on that from the standpoint of what it means for them. What does it mean to you to think of your addiction as a thorn in the flesh? What is it? What would it mean for you to actually be grateful to God that you have a struggle in your life? Well, those are totally, for most people early in recovery, those are very unfamiliar frames. They feel this deep shame. They feel this deep sense of regret. They don't see that in a way this could turn out to be a gift for them. And so there's a lot of sort of directed journaling around those passages about what it means to when we sort of hit that rock bottom. That's sort of what Paul is saying in that passage. You know, I've hit rock bottom and I need help. You know, I have to rely on God here. And so so there's a lot of journaling. We do a lot of trying to really slow people down, and we use journaling to do that and some different types of contemplative prayer and those types of things to slow people down. So that would be one example, I think, that that comes to mind for me. We also do a lot of talk. I'm going to jump around just a little bit. Let me stop there and see if you have any comments or questions about that before I talk about another one.
All right, no, I'm absolutely perfect with that. Continue.
Okay. So the other thing that's very interesting to me is emotions. And, you know, there's a chapter in Facing where Pat Carnes talks a good bit about, you know, sort of what's going on in my body. And, of course, for many people at least, the function of the addictive behavior is to avoid pain and these sort of undesirable emotions. And unfortunately, sometimes the church really reinforces that. I'll be candid and say this is my bias, and so it may or may not be universal, but I think sometimes the church with a capital C really struggles to understand that what people who are going through difficult times, who are very distressed, who are very upset, who are very sad, or who are very afraid, what they need is to be validated, to be heard, to be normalized. But I think often because of our own, you know, we're trained as therapists. We know how to sit with people who are going through these intense emotions and be present with them. But I think a lot of people are so uncomfortable with that they will start to throw out religious platitudes. Really these sort of shallow reassurances that just, I think, aren't really helpful in those moments, because more than, I think, the person who's hearing that, their primary experience is being invalidated. And psychologically, that just is not helpful to them. I think it's well-intentioned, but I think it's often misdirected. And so we talk a lot in the parallel chapter in Shadows of the Cross about emotions, and we use the example because a lot of times people will say, well, it's you should never be angry. Well, there are multiple accounts in the Bible of Jesus getting angry. I would argue it's righteous anger, but nonetheless, there are examples of him showing anger and showing sadness and showing fear. So, you know, as Christians, our model for emotions, our great spiritual teacher demonstrated that all of these emotions are healthy and we should have them, and that's okay. And so I think that's another, we do a lot of journaling around the messages that you've gotten in religion, in your religious community about your emotions, and how that's been helpful or unhelpful for you. And we sort of walk people through a series of different emotions that they're probably going through, because, of course, as you start the recovery process and sort of take away that coping strategy, those emotions start to really bubble up and can be a real threat to sobriety. So I think that's another one that's really important, is how, you know, sometimes the religious communities don't do a really good job of supporting people in their emotional lives. So we
now,
have to do a lot of work.
You can say that because certainly you have been a leader in the religious community. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background and where you've come from in the Christian community?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, my story is that I grew up in church. That was just, it was not questioned. That's what we did in my family of origin. And, I probably, at a personal level, I have some different beliefs now as an adult than I did as a child. It's evolved. But church was always sort of a place that was as a child and an adolescent, was kind of a mixed bag for me. Because I saw the community, I saw the love, I saw the outpouring of love, I saw the support, especially during distressful times when people were sick or when there were deaths in the church. I saw the way the community rallied around that in these beautiful ways. But I also saw sort of the shadow side of that. You know, there are a lot of unfinished folk in the church and who are still in the process of ripening or maturing, as the case may be, and they're hurt. And, you know, we have the saying, of course, that hurt people. So I saw some of the meanest, you know, growing up, I saw some of the meanest things done to people within religious communities. And so I was always a little bit conflicted in trying to sort of reconcile all of that. And I seriously thought about going into the ministry. As a college student, I had the good fortune to date my pastor's daughter. And the relationship didn't make it, but I learned through that process that I was not meant for pulpit ministry. That was once I got to see up close and personal what that job was. But I never, you know, I always sort of knew for me that long in my professional life, I've long sort of had this fascination with this integration of what healing actually means, and that either spiritual healing or psychological healing without the other is incomplete. And so that's really sort of been the impetus for a lot of my writing for probably the last 15 years or so, is sort of this integration of a healthy spiritual life with the psychological work that we all have to do. And because, you know, some of the hurtful things that I saw in the church growing up were people who were working the spiritual side of the street but not working the psychological side of the street. And so they were incomplete, and they weren't really kind of getting the kind of healing that I think would have made them more whole. So that professionally has been a fascination for me. I've been an ordained deacon in my faith community, have been for, gosh, I guess about 10 years now. But if ever, I mean, for me, it's my journey is always about living the questions, because the more I know, the less I understand, sort of thing. But there's a beauty in that for me. Just the mystery of all of this is pretty amazing to me. So I just sort of accept that I don't know a whole lot, but I'm on my own journey, and hopefully in this book we've been able to pull together some of the things that we stumbled into along the way that will be helpful to other people.
Thank you. You know, sometimes people wonder, well, you know, what is his background? Does he really understand the Christian community? And that really kind of gives them a bird's eye view of where you came from and what your position is. And obviously you've been doing Christian counseling for how many years?
Well, gosh, let's see. I finished my master's degree in counseling in 91, so 24 years, I guess. And then I went on to get a PhD, and I've been a faculty member for an educator now for about 20 years. But through most of those 20 years, I've maintained at least a part-time private practice, and I still today see, you know, a handful of clients a week. I wish I could see more, but there are only so many hours in the day. But, so it, for me, it really is an integration of these multiple identities, this interest that I have in addictions, my Christian journey, my academic journey as well. So it's been a wonderful opportunity to sort of pull those worlds together a bit.
Absolutely. And I know that you wrote that in the description of this book, Shadows of the Cross, that it provides an early spiritual focus to recovery while addressing issues of sexuality in a non-shaming way. And you said oftentimes in the Christian community, sex in and of itself can be very shaming. So can you talk a little bit about how biblical scripture encourages long-term recovery in a non-shaming way. I mean, what do you mean by this?
Yeah, so I think, you know, first of all, I think there are a lot of wonderful books that are out there that are written about recovery from a Christian perspective. This is certainly not the only one. But I do think that what's unique about this book is that it is written as this parallel to Facing the Shadows, and so it's written very overtly from this sort of task-centered model with an emphasis on the more spiritual aspects of those first seven tasks that are addressed in Facing. But, you know, we know that, I always say, shame is rocket fuel for addictions. And nothing will fire addictions quicker than shame. And so how we even talk about the word sin, I think, is really, really critical. Certainly, everyone that I work with who's in recovery, if they're actively in recovery, you know, I often hear people say, you know, I heard something in a meeting the other day. They said, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And I don't understand that, because I totally regret the past and I wish I could shut the door on it. Well, they're not there yet. You know, they haven't gotten to that point yet, but they're experiencing this deep shame over what they've done. They're starting to come into contact with how it's affected other people in their lives, partners, children, coworkers, lots of other people, partners, even the sex trafficking industry. I mean, they're really starting to come into contact with the consequences of their addictive behaviors. And so, as you know, anyone can do in that process, they run the risk of really sort of dropping into a shame spiral. And when you layer on top of that, if they grew up in a religious community that sort of focuses on a very judgmental, wrathful God who is sort of always pointing a finger at them and telling them how bad they are and how sinful they are, and that becomes even more of a complex struggle. So we're trying to really, in this book, I remember the first conversation we had, I said, this book has to talk about mercy and redemption and forgiveness and self-forgiveness and a loving God. That's got to be the focus of this book, because not everyone grows up exposed to those aspects of their higher power. And so we really wanted, even in talking about sin, you know, the word sin is a fascinating word. So sometimes it gets reduced to this set of certain behaviors. But if you look at the word that's actually translated as sin, it actually translates literally as an arrow missing its mark, which is fascinating, right? Because we can talk about sin as, you know, you strayed from God's path. God has a plan for your life. You know, we know in the book of Jeremiah, for I know the plans I have made for you, plans to prosper, plans for good. So you've gotten off that path somehow. So the idea of getting back on the path, getting back on the path that God intends you to walk, that's not nearly as shaming as sort of finger-pointing and talking about what a loathsome person you are. So I think that that's really kind of where we really tried to focus. It's not that there's not, obviously there's amends work to be done, there's forgiveness work to be done, there's self-forgiveness work to be done. So we're not trying to sugarcoat the past by any stretch of the imagination. We just sort of felt like from the outset of this book, what we felt led to do was, you know, finger-pointing and shaming people was actually going to do far more harm than good. So we really sort of highlighted the mercy of God and the love of God. And Scripture tells us that when we've done something wrong in the past, that God casts it as far as the east is from the west. Now, he forgets about it. He doesn't just forgive, he forgets. It's done. It's in the past. And as humans, we have a really hard time getting our small brains wrapped around that, but that's what we're told. And so that's really where we were coming from with the book, was trying to help people who may have a real proclivity to sort of fall into that shame spiral and be at higher risk for relapse, really to sort of unpack that a little bit and as you said earlier so well, recognize they're not alone, that a lot of people struggle with this, and that there's help, and that there can be help for it, and certainly healing and forgiveness for that.
Now, let the, you know, the listeners already know that this is a collaboration with you, Dr. Carnes, and then Penny Johnson Carnes, and mm-hmm. that it is Christian Companion to Facing the Shadows. But if you could talk a little bit about how this book is structured, because I do believe this workbook makes it easy to really self-assess where you're at and where you need to go. So talk a little bit, if you would, about the structure of this book.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question, I think. We spent a lot of time working on this and sort of working and reworking it to try to put it together in a way that would really, I think, hold together for people. So we have three initial chapters in the book that are really just sort of trying to help people understand. People come to me and even say, I've had people say to me, well, I can't be a sex addict because I'm a Christian, or I can't be a Christian because I'm a sex addict. And so we actually start the book by sort of saying, no, it's quite possible to be both of these things at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive. And here's what this means. Here's how we look at it through this lens, and that's where we talk about Paul's thorn in the flesh as an example, a possible example. And so that's really a lot of what we do in the first chapter, is just sort of trying to validate the struggle that people are going through, help them understand what it is that they're going through, and that there is help available. And then the second chapter of the book is strictly about spiritual disciplines. And, you know, a lot of, and we say from the outset, we're going to provide you with a buffet of spiritual practices. It's foolish to try to eat everything on the buffet, so don't even try. Just go through and sample what's on the buffet, and then when you go back for seconds, go back for the things that really seem to be impactful and meaningful for you. Because so often, you know, in religious communities, the spiritual practices, faith communities are sometimes so focused on what's called orthodoxy or right beliefs that they fall away from orthopraxy or right practice. And so we're focusing on helping people learn about different spiritual disciplines, how they can use different types of prayer and different types of practices to really sort of ground them in their spirituality and in their recovery, some of which can be used, for example, when they're triggered when they feel like they're at a high-risk time for relapse. They're, you know, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. They may need to reach out to someone. They may need to confess what they're struggling with. They may need to do a particular type of prayer. You know, it's about figuring out what works for you as an individual, but we want to expose people to more spiritual practices, Christian spiritual practices, than most people typically are exposed to in most religious communities. The third chapter, and this was originally later in the book, the third chapter is entitled Jesus and the 12 Steps. Because sometimes I hear people say, well, I go to a meeting, but, the 12 Steps just really aren't, they're using higher power language. They're not talking about Jesus, and I just don't see the connection between Jesus and the 12 Steps. There's actually been a lot of writing about how consistent the 12 Steps are with the Christian framework, and so we just literally roll that out step by step. Every step we pull from Scripture that connects to the step and talk about it within a Christian framework to try to help people see that step work is completely compatible with a Christian belief system. And then the rest of the chapters really sort of parallel the chapters in facing. And so within each chapter, there are places where we refer people over to facing to do some of the work, some of the performables in facing. So we sort of try to build a logical sequence for people to move back and forth between the two in a way that seems meaningful. There's a lot of journaling. There's some artwork, places where people have an opportunity to use their creativity to sort of also, which we know, kind of get in their right brain a little bit, use their more creative side to reflect on some things. And there are places where we encourage people to, a person could take these two books and work them by themselves, but some of the work is pretty deep work. And so there are lots of places in the book where we encourage people to reach out and, you know, to have safe counsel, as we call it, which could be a sponsor, it could be a therapist, it could be, you know, there are parts of this that we really encourage people to process with other people. So that's kind of the foundational structure of the book. We were told that books sell better than workbooks, so we call it a book, not a workbook, but it's definitely an experiential book, in that there's, just like with facing, there's a lot of self-directed writing and reflecting and prayer and meditation over particular aspects of recovery. So I don't know if that's what you were looking for, Carol, but that's kind of how we put the book together.
Well, absolutely, and that is exactly what I was looking for. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering, there are so many controversial social issues, such as same-sex relationships and abortion, sex outside of marriage, obviously premarital sex. How do you deal with these kind of controversial subjects that are not easy to talk about in the Christian community?
Yeah, they are very difficult to talk about. What we got clear about, what I think is kind of a funny story. Is before we had written a word of this book, but we had started to have some preliminary conversations about it. I sat down to pray and meditate and journal some, and was just really thinking about the book a lot. It was on my mind and on my heart. And so I closed my eyes and I began to pray and began to meditate a bit. And what came to me was the normal curve of all things. The bell curve was what kind of showed up in my mind. And I had to laugh because it's like I was thinking, you know, God can even speak to a nerdy academic like me. So and I had to laugh because Moses gets a burning bush. I get the normal curve as my vision. But what I realized early on, and what we talked about, Pat and Penny and I, and I also would want to give a shout out to Corinne Casanova, who is the publisher who worked with us on this book. It was just absolutely amazing to work with. But the idea was, you know, there are going to be folks. First of all, I guess I would want to say the term Christian isn't really, when you get down to those details, the social issues in particular, it's not a homogeneous group of people. People have different beliefs and different perspectives around this, and they're often quite passionate about it. And so why I think the normal curve showed up is the idea that, you know, there were probably going to be people who were extreme in their beliefs, extremely conservative, extremely liberal, who, you know, we just weren't going to get it right for everybody. It just wasn't possible. But we wanted to write this book in a way that would the largest number of people who were hurting possible. And the second you take a stand on any of those issues that you mentioned, and I think you hit the big ones. You said, you know, same-sex marriages, same-sex relationships, abortion, premarital sex. The second you take a stand on any of those issues, and I have my beliefs about them, and I'm very clear about what I believe. But the second we start addressing those issues in the book, we're going to lose a large number of our readers. We're going to take a stand that's too liberal for some or too conservative for some, and we just start losing more and more folks out of that normal curve. They just will drop away. They'll pull away from the work. And that was our desire, was really not to really kind of walk into anything that was going to do that. We wanted this book to be a healing book for as many people as possible. So we just got very clear from the outset that we weren't going to tackle those issues. We weren't going to address those issues. The focus of the book would be at a more macro level of, grace and redemption and mercy and forgiveness and healing. And that would be the umbrella for the book, if you will. Now, you know, if pastors are using the book, or if there are Christian groups that are doing this and they choose to do anything they do with that, of course, that's their choice. But from the book perspective, we just said, you know what, let's it's impossible to talk about these things without being polarizing. So let's not. I think that was a good choice. I still really believe that was a good decision therapeutically in terms of reaching the largest number of people possible.
Well, that makes total sense. And again, what you're trying to do is reach out to the masses and get this word out so that recovery can occur and shame can decrease and understanding, hope, strength, and recovery can also occur.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense. I wondered, though, because certainly I'm sure we have some lesbian or gay Christians. They're wondering, is this book for me? Will it work for me? And to that, you would say?
I would say absolutely so, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the fact that we don't address the issues doesn't mean that this book is not intended for anyone who's coming from a Christian framework. I think there's a lot of good writing out there now and a lot of good dialogue and a lot of good conversations as people look at how they integrate multiple identities. You know, we talk a lot now about the intersection of multiple identities. And so a person who, in fact, I've got a study under review right now, a qualitative study, where we looked at men and women who grew up in religious communities. And then, you know, usually during adolescence, they started becoming aware of same-sex attraction. And what did they do with that? How did they navigate that? Because I'm fascinated by that question. So yeah, there's absolutely nothing in this book that would preclude, I think, it being a useful tool for same-sex attracted individuals.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, for so many people that may have experienced an abortion or they are in a same-sex relationship, or, you know, what we certainly know to be true is that you may not be homosexual, but your sexual addiction has progressed to acts with people that, you know, you have no specific propensity for other than, again, rocket fuel for addiction. You know, it's good to know that this book would also speak to them and that they're not excluded from it. And, you know, I loved when you said shame is rocket fuel for addiction, because so many people who've had abortions, who have had premarital sex, who may be gay, lesbian, whatever, already have shame. And then you combine that with the shame of sexual addiction, and it's like they feel like they're marked for life. And this book, it has some hope, strength, and recovery for them.
Yeah, I think that's really true. You know, one of the things we talk about in the book is, as the saying goes, we're only as sick as our secrets. We do encourage people to be very intentional about to whom they disclose. And so because of some of the issues that you're talking about right now, because I've heard some absolutely wonderful stories of clergy, for example, who responded in such a gracious way to a confession about compulsive or addictive sexual behavior. But I've also heard some pretty horrific stories of people who've been tossed out of their churches and told they can't come back, or been told they can never work with any young people in their faith community again, even though there's nothing in their arousal template about children or adolescents. And so, you know, there's an ignorance and a fear. But of course, when I work with men who have been told they can't come back to their church community, at one of the most difficult, lowest points of their lives, they feel abandoned by the very people that, you know, they would hope would love them. And candidly, I think God gets conflated with that sometimes, because they're often very angry with God at that point, because it's hard. I think it's hard amidst all of the emotions and that are going on for them to sort of separate out being abandoned by, a religious leader and being abandoned by God. And so it's very complicated. So people, all of that is to say, and I think it ties into things like when we're disclosing things like premarital sex or same-sex attraction or same-sex behaviors, that we have to be intentional about who we disclose to. While we don't want to be keeping secrets, we have to also make sure that we're reaching out and talking to safe people who are going to help us in our healing and recovery journey.
Well, absolutely. I say, you know, the foundation for good recovery is to feel safe, feel connected, and to have trust. And so that means that you really have to decide who can provide that to you. So now, let's talk about how people can get this book, Shadows of the Cross. Where can they go?
Well, it's published by General Path Press, and so it's available on the General Path Press website. It's also available through Amazon, so you can easily get it, order it from either of those sites. I'm sure it's probably available elsewhere. Those are the two that I know about most readily.
Did I hear you give a shout-out to the publisher of General Path?
Yeah. I just,
she's,
you know,
wonderful.
She's amazing, you know. I remember when I got back the first, I think we had submitted maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 chapters, and I remember opening up that file going, well, here's where the rubber meets the road, and her editing was brilliant. So if you see something that's particularly well written in the book, there's probably about an 80% chance that Corrine was the one who actually made it sound good. So she really cleaned up our writing a lot, and was just such a delightful person to work with as well. One of the most professional, capable editors I've ever worked with. So, yeah, absolutely. I'm going to give a shout-out to her. She was delightful to work with.
Yeah, I'm giving that to her, too. She has helped me along the way a million. So I want, Craig, to thank you so much for sharing your expertise and getting the word out there that there is that kind of hope, strength, and recovery through Shadow of the Cross. For my listeners, I want to encourage you to take a look at this book. It's very affordable. $22.95, and it is a workbook, so it's not something you read alone. You actually have to do the work, too. And Dr. Carnes is a genius in terms of knowing what it takes to create both the tools, recovery, but also the networking, the connections, and the resourcing to make recovery possible. So I so thank you. I thank Penny. I thank him. And listen, keep me posted when you're doing other things. Our show would love to know about it because we want to spread the word.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Carol. It's a real privilege to be chatting with you.
All right. You take care and have a great week.
All right. Thanks, Carol.
Uh-huh. Okay. You were listening to just a prolific writer, Craig Ashwell. He's a PhD. And, of course, he wrote the book with Penny Johnson Carnes, Dr. Patrick Carnes, Shadows of the Cross, A Christian Companion Facing the Shadows. And I would highly recommend you get that. As well as, you know, I always believe in facing the shadows. And, you know, I just can't emphasize enough that you're not alone in this. There are many people that want to help. And bibliotherapy is a great way to make a difference in your life. So anytime you can have a workbook and take your feelings and write them out and externalize them, you're on the road to good recovery. So, as I say, at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. And I will catch you next week. Another riveting show, and feel free again to email me at carolthecoach@aol.com. Go to my website, sexhelpwithcarolthecoach.com, and thanks for the privilege to be able to share with you. Have a great week.